Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Greetings and salutations. You've successfully arrived at the Bloody Disgusting Network. The passage of time will now bring you to something strange, unique, and idiosyncratic. Have a good time.
Greetings, constant listeners. It's me, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman, and that is a fitting nickname for today because it's the 40th anniversary of Creepshow, one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite Stephen King movies, and certainly one of my favorite George A. Romero movies. So what are we doing here today? Well, we decided, because we're big fans of this movie, hell, we just had a film festival for 3 days in its name, we thought, well, we ranked all the vignettes back in, God, what was it, 2017, so we can't do that. We can share that link again, and, you know, there's not a lot of mileage to get out of it, but what do we have? We already talked to Greg Nicotero twice. Ah, geez. Well, oh my God, back in 2020, one of the worst years of all time, one of the best times we had was hopping on Zoom with Daniel Krauss, New York Times bestselling author, who at the time had just published The Living Dead, which was his collaboration with the late George A. Romero. And because I really wanted him on and the dead was on the mind, we decided to do a great episode on its very namesake Creepshow. So what you're about to hear is that episode, which was only for our patrons at the time, which was locked away in the Dairy Private Library, which you can unlock yourself if you become a member of our Patreon, www.patreon.com/thebarons. But right now, just sit back and relax, because you got about 90 minutes of us carving through one of the best horror movies of all time, and I don't think that's hyperbole to say. I love this movie. I'll watch this movie a million times. It's on Shudder right now. I probably watched it twice already since it dropped, and that's after watching it multiple times while doing all the prep work for the film festival that we had in September. God, I can't believe it was that long ago. 2 months. Time flies. Time does fly. I'm getting older. I'm almost 40 myself, and I'm certainly feeling the how time really isn't a shackle, so to speak. It just keeps flying by without it even knowing about it. So yeah, 2 months ago was the film festival. 5 years ago is when we first started talking about Creepshow on this very podcast. And 40 years ago, tonight, was when it premiered. God, what a good movie. I think I'm going to watch it again for the millionth time. But maybe I'll even just re-listen to this. Well, I know you will. So enjoy it, and I'll be seeing you over long days and pleasant nights.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you wanna make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of hope. All in the name of hope. All in the name of hope.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. I'm your host, Michael Monroeville Mall Rothman, and I'll be cracking open another installment of The Crate, our monthly deep dive into random horror rentals. Except this episode isn't so random. No, 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 no. It doesn't get more specific than this, because today we're talking about the very movie this feature gets its name from, George A. Romero's 1982 horror smash, Creepshow. Now, you're probably wondering, wait a second, Creepshow, 1982, hello, losers, you guys covered this back in 2017 with the New Flesh podcast, and you know what? My Horlicks hat is off to you, because we did cover this episode, but as our fellow patron, Anthony Stokart, said, well, he had another idea. He suggested, well, I had fun listening to the Creepshow podcast. I'd love to hear a show where people actually talk about the first movie as its own experience. Looking at those five stories as sort of a meal is different than ranking the segments from both movies. Just a thought. Well, Anthony, that thought is now a reality, because we're going all in on this midnight masterpiece for this special installment of The Crate.
So in fact, what makes it even more special is our special guest waiting for us down the basement. But before we meet him, let's introduce my fellow losers joining me in today's dissection. Here in Chicago.
This is Wolfman Mac. And I'm very excited to be on this Creepshow episode, as I was not on the first one. And big fan of Creep. And have been for a long time. I cannot remember the first time I saw this film, though. It had to have been early 90s, I guess. But, you know, you always catch one of the stories on TV at some point. But The Crate stuck with me. And as well as Something to Tide You Over.
Those two.
You know, haunted my dreams for a long time. So I can't wait to get into that.
Yeah, me too. Well, hey, get behind me. I got a flashlight. coming in from Nashville, Tennessee, all the way here to Horlicks University. How about that? Who's out there?
This is Jen 2, the Rage Adams. And I'm going to change it. This is Jen Justice for Wilma Adams.
Oh, okay.
I've got some thoughts about that. This was a first watch for me today. I was not on the first episode because I was only a listener back then. But I did listen to it. And I feel like I have read about this movie and heard about this movie. Like, I knew every single thing that was going to happen in this movie, and I've seen a lot of it, but it was the first time I actually sat down and watched it all the way through, and I really dug it. Not everything about it, but it was really fun.
Well, I can't wait to dig into it with you. This is a personal favorite of mine. Love it to death. This actually screened at the Greetings from Castle Rock Film Festival we did at the Music Box back in 2018, and it was huge. I mean, people came out in droves for it. I think it was our second best showing of that weekend after maybe Stand By Me, which really shows a dichotomy there. But well, are you two ready to meet our special guest?
Yeah.
He just texted me. He said there's quite a mess down in the basement, so let's go help him out. Daniel, are you down there?
I am down here. Yeah.
Daniel Krause, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Yeah. All things considered, which is what kind of you say now, the three words you end up saying, adding to any response. I'm good. All things considered.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Well, you know, you have a very, very special tie, to the director of this film. Would you care to digress on that tie?
Sure, sure. I co-authored the novel The Living Dead with George A. Romero, which is his kind of last word on zombies. So, you know, he directed Night of the Living Dead, obviously, in 1968, and then spent 50 years sort of making his six zombie films. And his last zombie work was this epic novel that he's called simply The Living Dead. And he died in 2017 before he could complete it. And I am a novelist and a lifelong fan and student of George Romero. And, you know, I saw Night of the Dead when I was 5 or 6 years old. So it really imprinted itself on me in a very, very deep way because it was always on. We always watched it. And, you know, his estate, his wife and manager reached out to me about a month after he died and said, look, he has this giant epic zombie novel that kind of ends the whole thing, and we wanted to know if you wanted to take a stab at finishing it. So I took that stab, and the book, it came out a few months ago. There you have it.
Well, it's an awesome book. It's a blast. It's the saddest thing is just knowing that we won't see the film under his direction. I imagine there could be someone that could direct it if they wanted to. I mean, they could easily turn it into a series, I imagine. Has there been any discussion on that end since it's come out? Or
yes.
Awesome. That is very exciting to hear. That is very exciting. Well, sticking with Romero, you know, you saw Night of the Living Dead at a young age. When did you first see Creepshow?
Now, I can't be sure of this, of course, because this was a long time ago, but I feel like the second Romero movie that made an impact on me was Creepshow. If I rank the Romero movies. And I don't think he ever made a bad movie. I may be alone in this crowd in that. But my second favorite is Creepshow. My first favorite is Night of the Living Dead. But Creepshow is a number two. And the first time I laid my eyes on it was at a friend's house. He had HBO and we weren't sitting down to watch it. I was just sort of in his house and we were in the living room and it was playing on HBO and it was The Crate and it was Mike the Janitor getting sucked into the crate. And there, and it was shocking because there was so much blood in that scene. It's like, it's the bloodiest scene in the movie and it's the bloodiest scene in most movies. Like it's just drenched with blood.
Yeah.
And the weird thing about this is I remember it distinctly because this was, must have been in the summer because it had to have been late enough to play an R-rated movie, but it still wasn't completely dark. And for some reason that just made it like all the more upsetting. Like it was still a little bit sunny out and yet this like person was screaming on the screen and blood was falling everywhere. And then from that, you know, I entered my Stephen King reading phase and my local library, and I grew up in a really small little town in Iowa. My local library had the Creepshow comic book.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And I got that and read it a million times and the obsession began.
Yeah. So with King, what would you say is, so this is pretty much your first King then, and then you went into, or did you, or had you already known King beforehand?
I mean, I doubt it was my first King movie. I can't put together the years all that well in my head back then. Certainly by the time I was maybe in fifth grade, sixth grade, that's when I started reading all the Stephen King books. So at that point I became just voracious. Like many people of my generation. So I don't know where they all kind of fit, but I think as far as the movies go, whether you're talking about Romero movies or Stephen King movies, certainly it is my favorite Stephen King movie.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about it today while watching it and just, we'll obviously talk about it in this episode, but it really does feel like such a great distillation of kind of not even just him, but also like what influenced him and stuff like that. And so I just, I love it for that. But in terms of his books, what would you say is your favorite of his that has really stuck with you over the years?
Well, I can tell you, it's a weird answer. My favorite of his books is Dance Macabre.
Nice. Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
That book more than any other book in history that I ever read changed my life. Because I lived in a small little rural town and this was pre-internet. And I didn't know it. I had no access to anything that wasn't thrust in front of me or that I rambled across in our tiny little library. So suddenly I get Dance Macabre and it was just, I was working my way through his books and this just happened to be the next one. It just opened up a million doors.
Yeah.
You know, there were all these books I'd never heard about and all these movies and TV shows and radio shows. And it just was like the world opened up with Dance Macabre. And I began a long journey that it still isn't complete of tracking down all those things. Yeah. Now so much is more available, but that book was a life changer.
Oh yeah. It's a total Bible. And I really didn't realize that until recently, because I wasn't on the episode for Dance Macabre, and we just kicked off a new series here that's called Dance Macabre, where we're trying to like go through the books of his that inspired him. And I'm like going through it. And this is like the one that was updated. So it has this like forward with like even more movies that he loves on it. And yeah, it's a maze. It's a fun maze to go through. And it's ultimately something I'll probably keep on the desk forever just because it's so easy to just kind of look at and just be like, especially right now where I kind of like when my girlfriend and I are trying to figure out what movies to watch during October, we're always like, oh God, so what do we want to do? You want to watch a... We're doing The Exorcist again, and we're doing that. So it's nice to be able to find something different because there is so many.
How many times you watch The Exorcist?
I know. Well, yeah, it's like a 2.5-hour movie, but
let's do it again.
Pop it on Thursday night. But yeah, I like that answer. That's a good one. Yeah. Well, look, let's start talking about Creepshow. And we're already in this section, but I got to label it because I got to throw on the seg and yada yada yada. But spiritually, we're all here in Horlicks University basement.
Christ, I can't see a friggin' thing. Where'd I leave my flashlight? You remember, Doc?
Never mind. Let's put this last name on it.
All right, well, in this section, as most of the constant listeners know, we're going to be talking about the background of the film and just how everything kind of came together. Short gist of it, from what I've gathered, is, you know, King and Romero were friends. Romero had done Martin. Warner Brothers approached him for Salem's Lot. Ultimately, they decided to do a TV movie with that. Stephen King left. So did Romero. Then they were like, all right, well, let's do The Stand. Not realizing how insane the budget is going to be on that. So they had to wait around for that. And then Romero was like, well, why don't you come up with an anthological story or something? And, you know, King was like, all right, I can make this screenplay in like 60 days. And thus, you know, Creepshow was born. I think I'm probably missing like half a dozen little tangents in there about this movie. But for me, like based on what I was reading today, it seems like that came down to it. I cannot tell if, because this is before Pet Sematary, because I know that was another project that Romero was circling after that as well. Daniel, am I right on this or am I?
Pet Sematary is 83.
Yeah. Okay, so then, but that was something that I know Romero was circling that, and then eventually Dark Half, I think, was the one that they basically agreed upon. All right, well, Pet Sematary.
Well, there was It as well.
And I mean, It, yeah.
Like, I've had the rare privilege of seeing the Romero archives, which will be public soon.
Oh, wow.
And so I've got, I've, you know, read or paged through a lot of these screenplays, the Pet Sematary and It, and...
Nice to see that.
The Stand and all that. Well, all that stuff will be, you'll be able to see all of it soon.
That's great. Yeah.
And it's, yeah, they came so close so many times. But yeah, it's great that this came together though, because I think it's hard to, essentially an adaptation of Stephen King's short stories.
Yeah.
Really. And it's I won't get ahead of myself. It's perfection.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of crazy too, because, you know, it really is just a greatest hits of all the masters of horror at that time. I mean, even those that aren't even involved. You know, the influence of Carpenter is on this with just pretty much all his cast from The Fog. you know, like I think the production team of Sleepaway Camp was also the team that worked with Romero here. You know, you get Tom Savini, who's doing all the crazy effects in the background, who also, because he had never really done monster stuff before, tapped Rob Bottin. So, I mean, you have that, you know, influence there. And then you also have Jack Kamen, who is doing all the actual physical, you know, comic books that are in there. So you got, you know, he had just done, you know, Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror. And then you also have Rick Catazone, who literally shared a building or an office that was next to Romero's. So it's like, and then also on top of that, this production birthed like, and then birth, but brought Greg Nicotero onto the scene. So he was a young kid that just, you know, this was his first experience. So it's kind of crazy how, you know, you mentioned Dance Macabre earlier, but this feels like almost like a Dance Macabre in 80s horror, because there's just so much, there's so many names involved here. And then you look at the talent that we'll talk about soon, but it's pretty wild. And it's a very exciting time for, I think, all the parties that were involved. You know, you got Savini coming off of, you know, God, a ton of huge triumphs for himself. In addition to John of the Dead, he had just done Friday the 13th. And then you have, you know, Romero, who's at that point just, you know, the master at that point. I mean, he's years removed from Dawn of the Dead. He just done Knight Riders, which is this brazen, unbelievable movie, where a lot of the talent in that is in this as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Stephen King is just at his coked out best right now. I mean, he's literally coming off of like Roadwork, Cujo, Dance Macabre, the year prior. This year, he literally released The Running Man, Gunslinger, and Different Seasons, and then also did the screenplay. So it's just literally everyone coming together. at this time when they're like all able to flex their toughest muscles. And I don't know, it's just, I think it really comes across on the film. And it's one of those things where you know, I come from a music background with Starting Consequence and all, but one of my favorite things, and I talk about this all the time on podcasts, is when chaotically all the elements just come together. And I always bring up Talking Heads once in a Lifetime, just because it's like, in that song, it was literally all the members are just coming in, recording one track after another, and it just birthed one of the greatest songs of all time. And it's this kind of the same way here. It's like everyone just came in with like their imagination, and it's just on screen. It's on display.
Mike, you know, what also came together that year was me, because I was born in 83.
Oh, look at that.
So throwing that, my hat in the ring there too.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, some other background, little notes I had here. This is just usually my little rundown to kind of give some stuff in here. But surprisingly enough, this is the only film that Romero didn't write the screenplay for. And also his only film to open up at number one, which is wild too, because it opened up on Wednesday, November 10th, 1982, grossed almost $6 million from only like 1,000 theaters. But it knocked out First Blood from the top of the box office. So,
oh
yeah.
Wow.
So I love that. I love that. And then some of their like production notes, I got like, you know, their real life maggots that were used in Father's Day. They used 20,000 cockroaches, which proved to be, I think, the most expensive part of the film for the creeping on you. And then that was also a real skeleton for the creep that was shipped to Savini. And he said in one of the notes I saw there, it was just like, he just got a box that said, you know, from India. It was this skeleton in there. Yeah. And it works. It looks like a skeleton, but,
wow.
Yeah. So well,
thank you to that person.
Right. Yeah.
But I feel like it was really, if you look at Romero's career, and you can kind of divide his films into independent productions and Hollywood productions, I feel like this was the sweet spot. Like this was I think maybe the only time that George, who had a very independent sensibility, worked totally in sync with the sort of the Hollywood end of things. I think they were generally a terrible fit. Like he just was not built to work with that kind of those kind of strictures and with those kind of producing partners. But with Creepshow, everything worked.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even down to the music, like I was thinking about today, just listening to John
Harrison.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of like the Halloween thing. Like if without it, I don't know if this movie works as well. I think it's one of these things where it's like all the moving pieces have to stay together for this thing to like really effectively work, because this could have gone so wrong, and it has gone wrong in like in the future. I mean, like, I don't want to like throw too many things under the bus, but like, you know, there's a certain, you know, there's some sequel. There's one sequel in particular we've talked about in this on this podcast, whatever else, but the third one, where you just see that, like, if you don't have the imagination, the creativity, and the muscle to be able to do it, it turns into a disaster. And this is, yeah, like, it's a 10 out of 10 for, like, pretty much every level of the production for this.
I mean, this is out of character for me to do this, but Creepshow 3 is maybe my least favorite movie I've ever seen.
Right?
I think it's a terrible, terrible film. And not only because it's bad, and not only because it shits on Mirror, or the first Creepshow and the second, I guess. But because it's like it misses the whole point. It feels really mean-spirited, whereas there's such a sense of joy about the first one.
Yeah, it like literally subverts the tagline with the third one, where we had to do it we have another feature called Lobstrosities, where you talk about like Stephen King sequels and try to see how they could connect if anything. And it was the most torturous experience we did. Like halfway, like about 5 minutes in, I like turned to the guests and I was like, I'm so sorry. Like really sorry that we had to sit there. And it's long too. I think it's like almost close to like 2 hours or something like that. But
I would just say that, you know, coming back to this, it was really interesting because I feel like you don't see a lot of anthology-esque films with just one director. Mm-hmm. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So like the vision is cohesive. And I think that really works. And I usually am all about seeing, you know, it's one thing if it's like up and coming directors and they want to give them a shot. So here's like four short horror stories. Great, cool. We have a lot of that. But if you're doing something like this, I almost think it's better just to have one vision because it really feels cohesive. And you know, the whole thing we're talking about today is viewing this movie as one whole piece of meat, you know? And I think that it works in that way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of anthologies, you can go, oh, well, I liked, you know, story two and maybe the through line or something, you know?
Yeah.
But I just think that's really weird because I was literally going through thinking, okay, well, who directed each one of these? And then I was like, hello,
it's all
George Romero. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the fact that Stephen King wrote the screenplay for the whole thing and that some are based on his stories. And so you can absolutely tell it's his dialogue.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
I mean, there was no one in there telling Steve to, you know, hold back.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he even reused some names too.
He does.
Yeah.
He does.
But yeah, it was a really fun rewatch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't always like notice production things or like, I kind of just watch things and kind of feel them out. And this one, it just felt so fun. And like, you can just feel the love when you're watching it. And I think that's what really sells it. You don't feel all the working parts, and there are a lot of working parts. And it just, I remember every time the screen would go red when the monster was eating somebody, I was like, oh my God, that's such a nice little touch. And it just, it makes the movie come alive, you know, and there's so much of that detail that I think it just feels like a love letter, you know, to like Halloween or like horror fans. And, you know, it was just fun.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I love about this is that it's not only is it cohesive, but I think one of the reasons why it works, and I talked a lot about this with the Creepshow TV show last year, which there are parts of the TV show I really like, but I think what it doesn't work, and I think a lot of things don't work with anthology films today, is because so many of these writers and so many of these directors, like, you know, someone like Romero or someone like, you know, like even like the mindset of Carpenter or you know, like King, they all cut their teeth having to really write like short serials and you know, short films and TV, and they grew up with, you know, the stories that are in magazines. I mean, like, that's how King cut his teeth also. And so, like, I think having that upbringing, and also, like, you know, they all grew up on the Twilight Zone most of the time when there wasn't really too much nostalgia tied to it yet. Like, it was still like kind of like a new thing. And like, you know, the horror in that respect was serialized. It was these short bites, that these quick fixes. And so when you have like a generation now that's trying to recapture that, it's like kind of doing like a second hand or third hand version of it. Third hand, really, because this would technically be the second hand, because a lot of the, you know, these are, you know, influenced by the Mathesons and, you know, the Serlings of that era. And I think that's really important. I think that, and I don't really hear a lot of people talk about that a lot of times, because like, it's, you know, just, it just, it's all commingled together. But like, I mean, my favorite King is Night Shift. And one of the things I love about Night Shift is the fact that these all speak to an author that not only knows the medium he's writing for, which is the time was a lot of like pulpy, you know, men's magazines, but also the audience. And so when you can nail those two things, I feel like that's why there's such a precision to a lot of this here, but I digress on that.
And like having fun with it too.
Yeah.
You know, this felt like, I kept thinking, this feels like watching Night Shift, you know, because there's just the DNA is throughout the whole thing.
I don't think it can be stressed enough. What a balance. I mean, it looks easy when you watch it because you're having fun, but to balance that much humor and to still be scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nearly impossible.
Uh-huh. Because there were some really upsetting things in this movie. Like, I got really freaked out at times, which I was not expecting.
Well, it's a huge feat. There's not a lot of folks that can do it. Obviously, there's only so many horror films that walk that line of comedy and horror. Well, But to what you were saying though, Mike, like trying to do Creepshow now is a little strange, because if you're trying to go after young demographics of kids, and your mirroring this off of like comic books. Like, I don't know what kids really, I mean, I know kids read a lot of graphic novels, and comic books have kind of turned into that more like trades and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's kind of the disconnect. Otherwise you're just making it for people like us, you know, who grew up with the show. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see like what works and doesn't work with the new show.
It kind of seems to me like it should work though in a certain way, because we are at an age now where we're the old standards of movies have to be a certain number of length, because you have to program a certain number of movies in a theater and maximize our time spent in that closed space are becoming less and less important. I think the feature, like when Host came out on Shudder recently,
yeah.
like it's an hour long, and I think that we're going to see a lot more of that. There's no reason anymore for us to tie ourselves to these certain lengths.
Mm-hmm.
I think short films or medium films or whatever kind of films are, this is the time I think you're going to see them continue to explode. And I think, you know, I realized that Quibi was kind of a failure, that streaming service. But I mean, I think it makes sense to me that short form projects and movies would make sense for right now. Like I do think there's a rationale that it, maybe they're not coming from comic books, but they are coming from YouTube. So it makes sense in a way.
I think
if you look at like TV now too, like we're in like the golden age of television, and a lot of the shows have been kind of playing with time length, you know, and like running over the hour or not going all the way to, because a lot of it is, or things that come out on Netflix that are just binging and it's not ever tied to any kind of programming. So that's interesting.
And then you get, you know, like Twin Peaks The Return, which is just just joking. Let's move on to our next section, because we got a lot of fun characters to talk about in this incredibly fun movie. You know, characters like your Henrys, your Billies, and your Fluffies.
I know you can get around.
What are you doing, Henry?
One of the things I really do appreciate about this film is the average age for the cast. This isn't like some, you know, young, hunky, star-studded thing. Like, it's not like they're going to have, like, you know, all the sexiest stars of the 80s coming together for this thing. And like, mm-hmm. it's
like
not.
The CW cast.
Exactly. Like, which is what happens when pretty much any goddamn production today. But like, I mean, I did the math.
Let's go down.
So Ed Harris was 32. Ooh. Stephen King was 35. Leslie Nielsen was 56. Ted Danson was 35. Galen Ross was 32. Hal Holbrook was 57. Adrian Barbeau was 37. Fritz Weaver was 56. E.G. Marshall was 68. Tom Atkins was 47. And I'm not counting Joe Hill. It's just, he's only in there for a couple of seconds. And granted, he's in there the same amount of time as Tom Atkins, but whatever. Hill, you're going to mess up my average, so I'm not adding you in there. But
he's an outlier. Yes,
yeah, so the average age of the cast when I did the whole averages was 45. That's, you just don't see that today. Like, it's just
that's refreshing.
Right? Like, yeah, I love that.
It really
that.
Is.
Yeah.
And I think that really speaks to the tone of this movie, because, like I said before, like, I mean, King wrote a lot of these stories for adult magazines, and there is certainly a tone of this film that is more, that leans adult, even if it's, you know, obviously using a medium that is for children. And I think that dichotomy is what makes this really work, because, you know, Daniel, you mentioned when you watched this early on HBO, I saw it the same way. I was at a sleepover. I woke up in the middle of the night, as I want to do. And just, this was on in the middle of the night. And it was literally like when Ted Danson is in the waves and he's watching Galen Ross on the screen. And I remember as a kid, I'm from a beach town, I'm from South Florida. I remember as a kid just being like, first off, what the fuck is going on in this? Why are they buried in the sand? And then second off, like, this feels like almost smutty. Like it felt like, am I watching like almost like a late night Skinamax movie, or am I watching like about cuckolding and all this stuff? Or am I, and granted, I didn't know what cuckolding was at age, you know, 10 or whatever, but I understood the smut element of it. Mm. So I always think back about that, because that's kind of what is really hard to also glean and kind of get, because most of the time horror, at least nowadays, is geared towards like young audiences. So they are going to go sexy. They are going to go with, you know, teenage and 20 something. So I really do love the fact that it's like, this is like adults that are the principal cast members. And it kind of makes the horror scarier, you know, because it's happening to adults. It's like, they should be in control. They should know what the hell they're doing, but nobody knows what they're doing in this.
Yeah. It's like a kid's version of what adults are, you know? Like a younger understanding of what being an adult actually is, which I think kind of leans into the fun. And that's why, like, you don't feel so attached to some of these adults, because you're not really identifying with too many of them. You know, you're kind of seeing them from afar. So like, almost like an us versus them kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the original like EC comics that these are based on, I'm kind of obsessed with them. So I've read them all many times, and they rarely involve children.
Yeah.
They're all adults. And I think with the idea being that kind of the evil one, because there's always somebody getting their just desserts, are adults. There's very few instances of evil kids. And I think this is a good example of, like, I've written books for all ages, adults and kids and all that stuff, but I've written a number of young adult books too. And I've never hewed to the idea that kids only want to read about kids and teens only want to read about teens. I just don't buy it. And I think Creepshow is a great example of that. Like, it involves older people, no one in their 20s, everyone's in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And I bet kids just loved it from the get-go.
Yeah. I mean, cause I think about, like, at the time I saw this, I was still being dragged to like family functions, or, you know, like, oh God, my mom, we used to have to like always go to these stupid like neighborhood functions, and everyone's drunk off their heads. And I'm just like sitting, like, you know, wandering around this adult person's like house being like, what do they have here? And like, you know, like looking at random things. And so, like, you know, the Crate episode really hits hard, because it's like, I feel like I've been to so many of those functions before. Like, I'm the one that's running around trying to like climb a tree, but like all the adults are just kind of like getting loaded. And there's like a cynicism that comes with it, because it's like, nobody really wants to be there. So they're just going to like escape into their drinks. And I've seen that happen firsthand. And so there is like a realism to it that I always connect with when I'm watching it here.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, as a kid, whenever you're watching something and the cast is just made up of older people, I always thought, I don't know if I should be watching this, especially in the horror genre. So I always felt like I was doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And that's fun, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I think of Ghost Story, you know, like that film. And I remember seeing that as a kid and just being like, man, like, it's like grandpas are being haunted, and like, and there's like a forbiddenness to it, which I think adds to it, you know? So look, we got a lot. I pretty much boiled it down to those characters that talent that's involved, because there's so many people in this, but let's talk about our favorite characters here. Jen, you mentioned Wilma before.
I did, yeah. And I don't know if I would say she's my favorite character, but she's probably the one I identified with the most, because I have been her at parties a lot of times. And I was like, oh my God, it's kind of bringing up some uncomfortable memories. I don't know if, like, she's like presented as an alcoholic in this movie, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And I think, like, I just kept thinking, like, you can just divorce her, you know, you don't have to kill her. And I was watching that, I was like, yeah, Hal Holbrook's the bad guy in this one, right? And I like I don't think she's really kind of given a fair shake. This is the one problem I have with this movie, is just, and I kind of lay it at Stephen King's feet, and it's, you know, as much as I love him, this is, I don't love how he wrote her. But I thought she was really fun and like having a lot of fun with this role. And I love Adrienne Barbeau. So I just kind of, I think in an updated movie, she would come back and maybe she's the new monster or something. And that was another thing that bugged me, is like everybody else gets to get their revenge, you know, and it's like Hal Holbrook gets revenge on her. So I want a little justice for Wilma.
Well, you brought up the idea that it's like they could just get divorced. And it's funny because it's like, that's another thing that happens in like something to tide you over. It's like, look, she just wants to leave. You know, and like Leslie Nielsen's like, I can't. And it's just like, well, you know, I'm a little, you know, he just indulges in his craziness. So it's like this, and again, like, can't, you know, a lot of, most of these short stories I imagine were, I know that, I think The Crate was, God, it was published in Gallery. So I imagine it's like, oh, for all the guys that are just like, oh, here's the story for all the men out there with the ball and chain, you know, like type of thing. That's kind of right. Like I get the gist of it.
Yeah, the ball and chain, my 20-year-old younger something attractive wife.
Yeah.
Right.
What's exactly. The issue here?
Yeah.
And I feel bad starting out saying something negative because that's really the only problem I have with the whole movie, you know.
Well, what other characters caught your eye though?
Well, Ted Danson is very hot in this movie. I was not prepared for that. Because that one was the one that freaked me out the most. And Leslie Nielsen, like, really creeped me out too. And then there's also hot Ed Harris, which is also a fan of.
It's kind of funny with the fact that Ed Harris is pretty much like, Ed Harris and Galen Ross are the youngest people on this cast list. Mm-hmm. And I always associate Ed Harris just from, I mean, he's got his hair here, so it's like he looks so young and he's also so zany and having fun in ways that like he doesn't traditionally after this, because like a year after he does write stuff and then from there on he's kind of like tough guy, you know, for the most part, but
it's like Starkey.
Speaking of hunky dancing, I mean, he's already, like, when this came out, this is 2 months into Cheers already, so he was already kind of like, I imagine everyone in America must have been like, no, don't drown Malone. Like, I love him. He's in that new show I love with Norm.
I never knew I would want to see Ed Harris dance so much, but that dancing sequence is like, it's definitely one of those scenes where you're like, they definitely were not dancing to this music. This music was added later on, you know? But and I'm always like, no, don't clap and don't snap. Because you know it's never going to be on beat with whatever they throw in there, you know? Oh, man, it is classic, though. I wanted to ask everybody, if you were on that grave, would you just sit there? Would you move? Now, I know that he's stunned by the grave moving, then Bedelia, and then seeing, you know, corpse of Nathan. Mm-hmm. But he's there for quite some time.
He's there,
like,
for a long time.
Move.
It's not going to get better by staying there.
But you get that all over this movie. Like, there's Mike the janitor, when he gets his hand caught in the crate and he just sort of sits there. And I think, again, that's sort of a carryover from the comics, where literally every other comic would have someone essentially go mad with fear and become catatonic. Mm-hmm. Like, almost all the last frame of those easy comics are somebody and their eyeball is just like white, you know, with no pupil in it. And they're just like burbling and with fear, and they're completely catatonic. So I think some of that is drawn from that idea.
Yeah. And if you think about it, it's like a static image as well that we're looking at. Linger on it a little bit. But yeah, I was thinking that too. And he makes the weirdest sound when he gets squashed.
I know. Well, everyone's like, so, and I mentioned, you know, obviously Coke before, but like, I just imagine just fucking everyone's going on.
You're projecting on this cast. There's nothing out there that says these people were all doing coke. Okay?
I just think like the given the time period and like the fact that like everyone's being basically told like, all right, you got to go Looney Tunes on you. I mean, like, they literally told Stephen King, I think he was like, all right, Wile E. Coyote. And he does. I mean, he goes beyond Wile E. Coyote. I think even Wile E. Coyote would be like, oh man, this guy, I got to get away from this guy. This is too much for me.
I loved it though.
I did too. And that's my girlfriend's favorite segment. She like cries every time during it. And I'm like,
it's so sad.
There were two characters that when I first watched it, I didn't like and really took me out of it. And that was Leslie Nielsen's character, because I had only ever seen him in other things that where he was playing a comedic character.
Mm-hmm. Which is so
funny.
Watching it
this time, it is like, he's so good in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I also feel like if we needed a stand-in, if they were ever going to do that again, he there's some lines that he does that it sounds like Mel Gibson. And I feel like Mel Gibson would be a good stand-in for that character if they ever had to do that again.
You did like, this to my...
Yeah, that'd be great, you know. God, I can't even imagine the headlines. It's like, Creep, but Mel Gibson joins Creep Show.
Yeah, right, it writes itself.
But the other character was, I'm totally blanking.
We had Leslie Nielsen. And then you also, were you going to say King as Jordy Verrill?
No, yeah. King. I was really put off by that. And I was like, this isn't scary. This is dumb, you know. And I was a stupid kid, you know. I wasn't like patient and really, really looking at it. And it is a very funny segment, but it is pretty disturbing. I actually like King in it. I think he's really fun. And you need him to be that goofy and kind of aloof for that last moment to really work and hit him. And man,
it's got such a dark ending.
It's so dark.
It is so jarring at the end. You're just like, oh God, like for this character to get to this point is really sad. Yeah. Quite good.
Well, Daniel, who are your favorite roles?
Well, you know, I did get to watch it again last night, which I didn't think I'd have time to, but I squeezed it in, and I mean, it was like the newer Blu-ray that's out. I just never get sick of this movie. I just loved it more than ever. And I think that the characters that I was particularly enamored with this time were actually Henry and Dex. I find their friendship so weirdly touching. Like I realize that they, you know, they should not have killed Billy. again, that's in every EC comic ever. Like there's some marital strife and one of them concocts some terrible way to butcher the other. But I found that all the murdering and monstering aside, I found Hal Holbrook and Fitch Weaver just like, I love their friendship.
Yeah.
Like they really care for each other. And they're these older, you know, men in their 60s or so who are just like real close and they're kind of rock for each other. And I found it kind of touching.
I agree.
Yeah, I also felt like when I watched this the first time that I, you know, when I'm thinking back of the movie, I was like, oh yeah, you know, they were both really evil, and that they both plotted to kill Billy. But really, is just Hal Holbrook. I mean, Dex just sleeps through the whole thing and then wakes up the next morning. He's actually quite sweet, and you know, he's like, even you know, they're opening the crate. He's like, Mike, you know, you do the honors. You know, I was like, oh wait, this is not how I remember this at all. But it's funny.
I think Fritz Weaver is unbelievable in this. I mean, like we talked about like the freeze frame and like how you have to have like the eyes and everything. His like discombobulated self towards the end of this, when he runs into to see Hal Holbrook, we actually use one of the clips in the podcast here. It's just so good. It, like you totally believe it. Like he's like, I never got a chance. And, like it's so real. And I you know, he'd been in a ton of. I mean, he was a better an actor at that point, but he'd also been in Twilight Zone. And I think that I want to say he's in the episode where they realize they're on Earth after it's like the shot into the clouds.
Yeah, section. I think that's right.
And that sort of that sort of mania really kind of takes off here. And it, cause you totally buy it, and it really elevates the tension of this chapter, because you get the sense that not only like his just nerves are like making you like just anxious watching him, but like, you feel the anxiety that like this fluffy creature is going to get them. Like they're right, like he's just right on their, you know, their tails. And so yeah, I love Fritz Weaver, and I love Holbrook in this too. But
Well, and I was gonna just draw attention to, you know, usually when you're watching horror films, I feel like a lot of times, if you know, we were talking about the age of the actors, and I feel like a lot of times they go with younger actors because they're not concerned about like, you know, they're fresh faces. They're trying to go all out in this movie, you know, and seemingly like horror isn't like necessarily a super popular genre, but I guess, you know, you've got Romero and Stephen King. So you bring in these seasoned actors, and a lot of them have done horror before, and they're just going for it, man. I mean, Leslie Nielsen, even when he's running around the house frightened, of the Wentworths coming after him, I mean, he is not holding back, you know what I mean? Like, and that really comes through. And I think that really sells it, you know, and because especially when you have so much comedy in this and so many, and just the comic book, you know, the drawings and the etchings and stuff, I feel like you have to be going all in for everything to come together. And I think it really kind of glues it and seals the deal.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be like a weak link either. It's like they're all like, they're aware of what they're doing. They're all kind of matching each other too, which I think would, like, lots of times when you're going for it and there's one person that's not, that's when it really stands out a lot. And yeah, they're all there.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Like, everybody's on the same page, you know?
I imagine that George's conversations with the actors was a lot of give me more. Yeah, even more, you know?
Yeah.
No, you don't look weird. Yeah, go for it. Keep going. Yeah.
And it helps that, like, so many of them have, like, been on television, you know? And I think that to be able, especially not only just been on television, but, like, you know, one-off roles where you really kind of have to just, like, own it as a young actor. I mean, especially with the, you know, the younger cast. I mean, like someone like Danson, who at the time, you know, when we look back now, we're like, oh yeah, Cheers, first season, huge. And it was huge, but he still was, like, you know, working from project to project. I mean, like, he had done like Body Heat. This is, I think, his, like, third movie at the time. So you have, like, a lot of hungry, really good, like chiseled actors at this point where that have really, like, gone through the rigmarole of, like, television, you know, serialized movie making or, like, filming. And I think that helps with these, like, segmented things, because they know that, like, all right, well, we only have this abbreviated amount of time. I really got to make this count. And it also helps that you have a lot of actors that really come from, you know, on the other side, the older actors that come from a time when a lot of filmmaking was even more, like, theatrical, like, because you really had to kind of emote through a lot of things. And, like, somebody like, I think of somebody like E.G. Marshall, where that entire segment is literally on him. Like, there's nobody there other than the bugs and the, you know, the doorman and all, but it really is on him. And in lesser hands, that could have just been so lame and, you know, over-exaggerated and just kind of boring and tedious, but he really owns it. And a lot of that speaks to the fact that, I mean, he was in 12 Angry Men, which is pretty much a theatrical, I mean, Love, Sidney Lumet movie is amazing, but it's a stage production that's made into a movie. And, like, and he's one of the MVPs of that movie. And, like, he comes in that, and, like, having someone that caliber really makes a difference. And that's why I think a lot of anthology horror today just doesn't work, because, like, everyone kind of treats it just like a regular movie. So it's just like, well, you know, we're not really owning the scenes and all, but, I guess my question here next is, you know, who from this era, or maybe from Romero's circles, do you feel like are missing? You know, because Galen Ross was in, you know, Dawn of the Dead, King and Ed Harris were both in Knight Riders. I don't know how they got Leslie Nielsen after Airplane, because it was, like, the fourth highest grossing film of 1980. So it's, I don't know how they managed to get him, but, I'm wondering, like, if are there people from the 80s that you would wish that you might have been able to see play characters in here, or even those that were regulars of Romero?
Ken Foree.
Yeah,
that would have been fun to see him in this. I was surprised to see Galen Ross. I never knew that was her, which is crazy. And she, you know, she only did a handful of things, but that was fun. Yeah.
And of course, that's John Amplis playing Nathan Graham under the decaying corpse suit. So that's Martin himself.
That's so cool. That's yeah. I'm trying to think of, like, I'm just surprised that there weren't, like, even more people from, like, Don or you know, some of his other films that he had I mean, like, obviously he carried over a ton from Knight Riders, but just dawned on me that,
yeah,
no pun intended, that there weren't as many as he could have had here. I mean, maybe they just, I mean, there aren't that many roles, to be honest with you. I guess there's
also, I think probably just because of the budget and the situation of the production there and the, you know, most of the budget, they had to put in a certain number of names.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't just cast the people he liked as much.
Yeah.
So there's some of that, but he also needed to have the Leslie Nielsens and the E.G. Marshalls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
I think it rounded it out really nicely. I mean, then you have Tom Atkins.
I know. We have to mention
that
Tom
guy
Atkins
and everything, please. Mm. Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
I think this might be, like, Atkins' probably not Finest Hour, obviously, just because he's been in so many other things and all. But like, man, what a great era for Atkins. I mean, he had just done The Fog and Escape from New York. Halloween 3 is coming up. The Creeps, and I know The Creeps is coming up. Like, going to have Lethal Weapon soon. It's kind of interesting to see, like, I mean, he was 47 at the time, and it still felt like his career had just begun here.
That's insane. He was 47?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I'm telling you.
He's also really bad in this. Like a mean guy.
Oh, I know.
Oh, yeah.
You don't see that usually.
No.
My notes I wrote, that's why God make fathers and Israel. I hate him. He's just such a good bad guy.
Well, that's the thing I love is that like it really, again, it taps into that, like, he pretty much dies, right? I mean, like his son, Joe Hill, kills him, right? Like,
yeah. Eventually, yeah. Yeah, I think.
Absolutely. Mm. I love that opening. And I love when the kid's just sitting there on the bed and he sees the creep, mm-hmm. and you think, oh my God, this is like frightening. And the kid's just like beaming, like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, like the creep's here. We're going to do this.
Yeah. I mean, that sets the tone for the whole thing, right?
It does.
Like, you expect him to scream because there's a skeleton at the window. And the fact that he gives you this devilish little grin,
yeah.
You're like, oh, so okay, this is going to be that kind of movie.
Yeah. Well, and considering how little screen time they both have, like, I think it speaks to their, like, the way they deliver this. Like, speaking of just going for it, that they are memorable for that small amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so mean. Like, or not mean, yeah. But it's fun mean. It's like, it's very merciless. Like, you just know that, like, all bets are off, that, like, anyone's fair game in this world. And I love that about it. I mean, it really does. It's funny that, like, you know, obviously it was etched by the same person who did Tales from the Crypt, but like, God, the show that would come on later on just has so much spiritual ties to this, that like, cause like you watch that show and you're like, I just assumed at some point growing up that like everyone's fucked. Like the minute you see a character in a Tales from the Crypt episode, you're like, oh man, you wound up in this world.
They're
like,
done.
You're so finished. But okay, so last question with the cast. Like, who wins Creepshow here? Like, who's the MVP of this cast?
Joe Hill?
Oh, Joe Hill?
I don't know. There's really not, like, a...
You know, I never would have said this as a younger person. Like, because you're just not that interested in the Hal Holbrooks and the Fitzweavers.
Yeah.
But man, do I just... This movie makes me miss Hal Holbrook. Like, he's just such an interesting presence.
Yeah.
I think maybe if you're doing an MVP, we kind of go back to the idea that there's two segments that just have one actor, basically.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'd probably lean towards giving E.G. Marshall the MVP, just because he has to come in the final act and take it away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to give the MVP to... the crate creature, because he gets away in the end. He breaks out. He breaks free.
I mean, it is great. When you think about the iconography of this film, you got the comic book, you got the creep, and you got Fluffy. I mean, I feel like I see more Fluffy than anything else that's tied to this. I mean, like, I had the chance to go to the set for the Creepshow TV show last year, and back when you could still go on sets, and they had so much like little prompts and things that they probably they're reproductions of the original film, and you know, they had Nathan, and that was really cool, but everyone gravitated towards the Fluffy mask, even though like you go to any Halloween store and they pretty much have it there, but it was like sitting there in the corner and everyone was taking photos and going nuts, and it kind of really spoke to the idea that like, I guess the crate really is the one that like everyone thinks about, like it just, because I guess maybe it's ultimately the scariest one, but it is. You could say Fluffy is MVP. I think that'd be fair.
Yeah,
the crate is, I think, by far the longest one, and
it is, yeah.
And has the most star power. If you look at the credits, you know, the first four people listed in the credits are in the crate.
Yeah,
that was the centerpiece.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So I think good. I would give it to, if I'm thinking about the most memorable part of this, I think I would probably give it to Leslie Nielsen, because that performance just really got under my skin, you know? And that's the one that I have come back to when I think about it. Even just seeing it for the first time today, like, that's the one that I connected with the most, just from everything that I'd always heard and known. And that's the part that I'd seen before. So
when he captures that King character so well.
Yeah, like, he does.
Kind of like what we see in The Ledge. mm-hmm. Where it's like this
this
like cuckolded man that is very wealthy, very opulent, and like very smart, you know. He's gonna have this, the, you know, two steps ahead. And yeah, that's another, you know, not to go too much on a tangent, but like that was one thing I did realize watching this, is that like nowadays we're so obsessed with being nostalgic and vintage, but like this era, because there was really only like, I mean, it's the 80s, so everything was excess and stuff, but like, or starting to become that in 1982. It is interesting to see that like two of the five stories in here have to do with like multimedia, you know, mm-hmm. and like really advanced multimedia. The fact that like, you know, he's got these cameras everywhere, and then, you know, later on, with the Creeping on You, it, like there's all the camera work and his way of, you know, creating his own little bubble there. And it's very like this kind of, it's not Dark Deco futuristic, but like it's this weird sort of like 80s futurism that's happening mm-hmm. in these two segments. And you just don't really see that anymore today. Like, I mean, it's, I feel like the 80s was like, maybe the 90s was like the last gasp.
You don't
of like,
have, you don't have like artwork that moves and then there's like 10 TVs behind it.
Oh no.
Well, let me just push the button on my remote.
But I know, I thought that was kind of cool. But if I had to choose an MVP, I think I would go with, I don't know, EG's pretty great. Like I think that's probably the fair answer. But I think I'm gonna go with Barbeau. I'm gonna apply for Barbeau, because I think she just steals the scene and everything. And like, if I'm thinking of an actor or an actress or talent, like, I remember how excited I was that Adrienne Barbeau came back for the TV show last year. Like, I was mm-hmm. just like, oh yeah, like this is awesome. Like, you know, she's that scream when she finally sees Fluffy. Like, I've used that GIF so many times. And and even growing up, I think it was like one of the first things I saw was like the cocktail party. And I love her in this. And I love Barbeau anyway. And I think this is such a great era for her too, because she was, you know, she's married to Carpenter. She just kills it in The Fog. My favorite character in The Fog. Mm-hmm. You know, starting out pretty late too. So it was, you know, nice moment for her. But okay. Well, we've talked a lot about what we love in this cast. Let's talk about some stuff we didn't like. She might be a little short in this segment, but it's a segment we call Shit for Brains.
Same old Henry, afraid of your own shadow. You know what, Henry? You're a regular barnyard exhibit. Sheep's eyes, chicken guts, piggy friends, and shit for brains.
This is the section that, you know, we talk about stuff that we didn't like. And I got to say, my notes have just one line, and that's it. I'll hold on to it right now. But Jen, you've already mentioned and acknowledged some things you didn't like, but were there anything beyond the treatment of Wampa?
I have a couple of lines I did not like that Don't Let Go song, which is such a minor thing, but it comes back twice and it bugged me. And the other thing that I did not like was the bugs, and that it's very effective. I just don't like bugs. And
I know,
so
I hate them.
I think if I watch it again,
the whole point though. You can't say I didn't like this movie because there were bugs in the scene where there were supposed to be bugs.
I think it's effective. It's great. It just fucked with me, man.
My mom used to drive me crazy because she'd watch a horror movie and say, oh, I hated that movie. It was so scary. Like, yes. So you loved it.
It's supposed to be scary. Yeah. Hey, and it was effective, and I've watched it once, and I was very affected by it, and now I will maybe just push stop.
But you know what? I'll build on that, because the cereal scene, and especially when he uses it to, like, I hate that. I just, like, mm-hmm. I have to turn away every time because it looks so fucking gross.
Yeah. And
the cereal all looks like the bugs anyway. It just, like, it really gets under my skin on that.
And that maybe is a little unfair, because you're right. It is very effective and gross, and that's why I don't like it. And I think that just kind of speaks to, like, there really wasn't that much that I didn't like. You know, everything else, like, really worked, you know?
Yeah. Daniel, what about you?
I actually think there is one big strike against this movie, and that it's incredibly white. You know, if you look back at the EC Comics, we're talking the 1950s, and those were, you know, pretty much 100% white. This is 82, hardly a progressive era, but, you know, 30 years have passed. Like, that, it's kind of inexcusable that there are, with the exception of a minor character in the very last segment, this is 100% white.
Yeah.
And there's just really no good reason for that.
Yeah.
And it's surprising coming from Romero too, because it's like, you know, all of his films.
Yeah. I'm guessing. And I know, I'm trying to think, was it this movie? Because something, I have some sort of like unique insight from talking to Romero people, like the estate and stuff. I can't remember the specifics, but it was more Land of the Dead. It wasn't this one. But I know like with Land of the Dead, he wanted to cast a black actor in the lead.
Oh, interesting.
And he wasn't allowed to, essentially. So I would not shock me at all if that was what he tried to do here too. And the producers were just like, no, we got to stock it with these various names. Mm. So shock me if he put up a fight and just lost.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I'm going to throw out, and we talked about, you know, it's a Stephen King podcast. We talked about King all the time. He's not the best at writing non-mainers. So yeah. That might've had something to do with it eventually, but it is weird. Yeah. It is shockingly white, and you know, most of them are evil. So maybe they were trying to say something with that.
Well, I think that the last one is actually kind of making sort of a commentary on that. And there's like an eliteness, but the problem is there are four other sections and they all, not including the wraparound, which does not include any characters of color either. So
And I think you could have, I'm trying to think which section would have really worked. I think the crate, honestly, like would have really worked, especially if you had like, I don't want to get rid of like Hal Holbrook or Fritz Lang, but like Fritz Lang, I don't want to get rid of, the characters, but like, I feel like Ken Foree could have like easily like fit in there as like one, like a colleague or something like that. Like, or even like the second lead in that section.
The Ed Harris role, being brought into a rich white family and trying to fit in.
Yeah, that makes total sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. I always forget that he is the outsider in that, that would absolutely make sense. For me, I mean, speaking of Father's Day, I think that one goes a little too long. Mm. I think it's, and I'm sure that it's really not too long because obviously the crate is longer, but I just think it's, out of all the segments, I think that was when we did our ranking for the podcast, I think it like, that's my lowest ranked one of this movie. Something that just doesn't work about it for me. I love the ending. I love where it goes. The makeup effects are phenomenal. It's just, I can't really grapple into it. Like if I'm seeing it on TV, I'm like, oh, Creepshow's on. And I'll get it sucked in, but like,
it's a very complicated plot for the first one. There's so many characters and you're like, okay, who's not related, who's actually related to the person that did die, but then why are these people, why is he even here? But I always remember that being a lot longer than it was. And when I watched this time, I actually really enjoyed it. And I think, I just read this recently too. And I thought, it really worked for me. I think in terms of setting up the comic book aspect of it, I think it really delivers with, the Father's Day bit and everything. But it's not my favorite of the bunch, but you're always going to have something that's not your favorite, you know.
Loved that one. That was my second favorite.
Yeah, I mean, when we did anthology piece on Consequence, they picked like the best segment for each one and they picked that one. I remember like editing it and being like, wow, this is not it. Should have been the crate. But anyway, let's head under the stairs.
It's easier if I just, I'll show you, I think. Come on down.
What's this?
Well, this is pretty easy. This is a section that we talk about the scariest moments. Jen, you already outlined one. You hate the bugs. For me, it's the overall tone. I think that this, as I mentioned before, it's a merciless world with evil in all corners. And as a kid, that really got me.
I got to go with the something that passed the tide. Just the idea of being buried in sand. I just remember when I first watched that, I was so uncomfortable. And I have some claustrophobia stuff. But man, that is the way, that is the worst way to go out. Because it's such a slow burn of a death. And I was really frustrated. I was really upset that, the good guys were essentially getting killed. Good guys, I don't know, I guess they're cheating on them. But
Yeah, he's a jerk.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, that really stuck with me. I think the last Father's Day scare where he opens the door and you see him there with the head on the plate, I think that's really effective still. And I don't know, there's a lot more. Scary in terms of continuity. I was really upset that the ashtray used in the first sequence is shown in every single No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's a haunted ashtray.
I actually like that. I actually noticed that this time. I like that.
And apparently it's been in every Creepshow TV show episode too.
Oh,
really? Cool. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Daniel, what scared
you? Well, I've got two, and the first one is the same one. I think there's something really upsetting about the being buried in the sand. And I think you mentioned it earlier when you were saying that it felt smutty. There's something the fact that you're seeing it recorded and played in this little black and white TV that makes it feel like a snuff film.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like it feels particularly dirty in a way. Like it's not just a death in a movie. It's a death that's being recorded. And it gives an extra level of ickiness. And then secondly, I would just go to one we mentioned earlier, the end of Jordy Verrill, because you've got this funny character who's playing a cartoon character who you love. And it's like watching, you know, Daffy Duck commit suicide at the end of an episode. It's just like, it feels like wildly inappropriate. And therefore I love it, of course. But it's just like, God, that's just so harsh.
It's really harsh.
And that segment is so hopeless.
Yeah.
Like he says, you know, I touched that green stuff and I'm a goner. And he's exactly right. Like there's no hope in that episode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, and then they even kind of hint that the whole world's going to get it because the rain, it's like the weather is perfect for, you know, growing crops and stuff, which is bye-bye Castle Rock. But Jen, what about you?
Yeah, I like that too.
Keep Maine green. Yeah.
I love it. Jen, what else got under your skin?
Well, I love when Ed Harris is in the cemetery, and it's just so creepy, and it's like that level of like Halloween fun creepiness that I just love. And I think that kind of goes with the visual colors and kind of the surreal quality of it. But yeah, it's the Tide Me Over one. I was watching that and I knew exactly what was going to happen, and I'd even seen parts of it. And I still found myself like feeling very claustrophobic when I was watching Ted Danson in the sand. And I was like, well, can I, like trying to think if I could move when I was there. And then as he watches,
Galen Ross. It's so tragic. Like,
oh, it's, and like to watch that happen to the woman that you love.
Yeah.
It's about to happen to you. And I just like the moment when the camera is on the beach and the water is just coming right towards his face, I just remember thinking, it just really upset me.
It's
and
really cruel. Yeah,
it really it is. And to have Leslie Nielsen, who is this person that I love because I grew up watching The Naked Gun and like Hot Shots, like narrating what's going to happen to him, and like you got to take a breath and like, but not too fast and don't panic, and it just really upset me a lot more than I thought it was going to.
That was the scene that I came across when I was younger, and like the cruelty of it, and the fact that no one's doing anything, and like the fact that he had to wash, like that really stuck with me. Like it is haunting, like those two TV sets, and also just the setup is so surreal. And especially like for me, it was, I literally had woken up. So to wake up to that, and it's already surreal enough, it looks like a goddamn Pink Floyd album cover. Yeah. That gets me. And also, you know, shout out to Tom Savini, but the exploding body with the cockroaches is so gross.
Yeah.
And like, it's so disgusting when you see it like on the face and in the forehead, and like, it's just, it still gets me. And dealing
they have
with
blood on them.
Yeah. It's so gross. Fucking disgusting. And like, every time. And it's the paranoia, you know, there's obviously the commentary of what it means and everything, but just from a literal sense, I mean, I'm dealing with like some flies in the house right now. Like when you're just killing one and then you look over and there's another one, and it's just like, maybe it's because I literally just watched this, but it really did capture the mania of, like, when you see another one, you're like, why are you doing? And you, like, you just, you don't, you lose all sense of comfort.
Yeah.
And it's, your world is just taken away from you. And Romero does a great job. And it's, you know, it's so much better than the original idea that they had, which was, I think it was going to be like a carpeted penthouse. I love the fact that it's this weird postmodern
sterilized environment,
sterile hospital thing. It's so disgusting. And he has that little button. It's just, the loss of control here is just,
I was watching this and I was like, is this like a found footage kind of precursor? You know, because like when I'm looking at the screen, I was like scanning it to see if I could find any of the roaches around, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like the way I find myself doing Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
I say also the, anytime the crate monster attacks, especially that first one, because
the face.
Mike seems like such a nice guy. Yeah. And just tearing through the face and everything, though. Yeah, that too. Oh.
Love his eye. The eye's already like busted.
But just when you see the monster's eyes, like, I just remember being so frightened of that as a kid. Yeah. I think that's great. Yeah.
Well, preys upon the fear that we all have as kids that there's something under the stairs, you know? And it's so perfect. And that, like, this is, it's also, so, again, it's so surreal too, because it's like, what the hell is this box doing there? You know, it's just been there the whole time. Like, that at this random university is so odd. And that was like always the most perplexing thing to me growing up. You know, I'm OCD and stuff. So I just sit there just being like, what is that? Why is the box there the whole time? Like, how did it feed? And like, is it just so hungry? And that's why I was angry.
It was
and,
dormant, you know. Mike. It was dormant.
Yeah. I love it.
That's one thing that I think the show, the Creepshow TV show has done a good job at, is not explaining things. Like they're just the way it is. You know, there's this finger that goes to a monster. Yeah. Deal with it.
Yeah. I love that. Anytime you have to explain anything, it's like, no, you know, and you know, Daniel, you mentioned something in your intro for Night of the Living Dead, about how Romero hated the fact that like people wanted to explain it, or like there was that once mention of the satellite and everyone like took that as a reason for, you know, why the dead walk, but and it's so frustrating because like, it's so much better when you don't know and that you don't have any.
Yeah. When we worked on the novel, like his manuscript made it very clear that we were never going to answer that question.
Love it.
Because once you do that, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
It loses all like metaphorical value.
Oh, totally. Totally. Wish more horror movies today would just learn from that and just be like, look, let's just keep the lights off. Well, we're going to turn the lights on for our next segment, probably just for a short bit, because there's not really much, even though it was written by King. We're going to talk about the connections to King's Dominion in a section we like to call, you guessed it, King's Dominion.
Oh, you done it now, Jordy Verrill. You monkhead.
All right, I scoured this movie today. I just combed through all of it. The only thing I could think of that has any remote connection to other Stephen King works is just the mention of Castle Rock at the end of the Jordy Verrill thing. I couldn't think of any.
Oh, I got one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Arnie's parents work at Horlicks University, I think. Arnie Henningham and Christine.
Oh. Yes, I knew there was a connection to Pittsburgh somehow.
Yeah, I think that's the only other care there. I wanted to think, I was thinking, I know what you need. Is it Horlicks or Strawberry Spring? But I would have to check that.
But is that a flash forward though? Like, did it start with Creepshow and then he added it?
Could be.
That doesn't mean it's not a connection though. That doesn't,
yeah,
that doesn't,
yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, you're right.
But that's still fun. Yeah,
because it came around, I think Christine was 83, right? It was like 82, 83.
Christine is 83.
Yeah. So it's right around the time. It makes
sense.
Yeah,
he's probably writing it around then. Yeah.
I feel like Horlicks comes up so much. Like, and it's so weird how many ties are just like in that thing. Like, the crate itself is like tied to like the thing with the Antarctica expedition and all. Like, I just love that, those little fucking Easter eggs and stuff. But,
which is Ed Harris being in this and being in a bunch of other stuff.
Ed Harris. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess Ed Harris would be the only link to the other King one, the King work. So, like, I was trying to think of anything else that I don't think of any. I just can't think of any off the top of my head. I think that's it, which is so weird because he wrote all of them. So, yeah. I mean, I guess that this is this is the year that he wrote The Dark Tower, like, or kicked off The Dark Tower. So you'd think, like, come on, King. What are you doing? All right. Well, does anyone have any other? No?
No, that's all I had.
All right. Well, let's go to a fun section. It's the most ridiculous section of this episode, called The Creep Show.
We gotta stop. Dear Christ, they died. Hey, Dex.
Hold it. What happened?
All right. Daniel, you do not have to partake in this if you don't want to. This is where we we go over some quotes. We say some quotes. We try to redo them ourselves and act them out. Max sent over some in the email before. We don't have to do all of them. I think we could, for brevity's sake, we could probably just do maybe like one or two.
I think we could start off by just talking about some of our favorite quotes.
Yeah.
Because some of them are just short, you know.
That's true. Well, hey, kick it off, Mac.
Love the Jordy Verrill line, Risa. Verrill's luck's always in, and you spell that kind of luck B-A-G. Still, I gotta try. Meteor shit. I mean, I don't see anybody else in that role. I can't imagine anyone else doing those lines and selling them. Like, you know, you're like, oh, wow, Steve, like, if people only knew this is how your brain worked and this is how your character spoke, like,
it brings what if that's totally how all of them life. Are in his mind?
yeah.
Like, that's how he sees Stu, you know?
What do they approach, like, Orson Welles at the time? Say, hey, you
know. Yeah. Stu Redman is actually Jordy.
No, it's like, but like, you go like, hey, Orson Welles, look, we got a character, Jordy Verrill. Why don't you come in and play it? Here are some lines that Steven wrote. I mean, for me, it's everything Billy says. I think they're so funny, and it's just so insane. Like, I love when she grabs the you know, the total just loafs that came into the party and haven't had a drink yet. And she's just like, she like runs up to the table and it's like, they're dry. You better get them a drink or whatever. And like, you can just tell they're just so like, I don't know who this person is. Like, it's just like, in just the way that she just strips down Hal Holbrook is just phenomenal. I'm trying to think of any lines that like come out, but like, I mean, shit for brains is obviously the big one. I mean, it's so vulgar. Some of the more, you know, iconic lines of this that, again, goes into the pulpiness of it. But Jen, what about you? What were some lines that spoke to you?
Well, I really wanted cake while I was watching this because there's the I want my cake.
That's great.
But one of the ones that from Jordy Verrill that cracked me up is when he's about to take a bath and he says, oh no, not there, when he realizes like there's green stuff other places too. I also wrote, I can't remember who said this, but I wrote, been off on a hell of a toot. And I'm going to have to start incorporating that into my everyday language. And then in the very last one, he says, everybody's got the damn herpes these days.
Which is so, like, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. His, everything that E.G. says in that final segment is so fucking good.
Yeah. I've given Stephen King a lot of shit for his dialogue in the past, but this is kind of the time when it works really well because it just fits the tone, you know?
Yeah. I love everything Billy's father says. I'm going to take this one, Mac. Billy's father is like, I've told you before. I don't want you to read this crap. I never saw such rotten crap in my life. Where do you get this shit? Who sells it to you? I'm talking to you, young man. Answer me when I talk to you. Remember who puts the bread on the goddamn table around here? Like, it's just
like
so
who would
vitriolic.
Say that to a kid?
I know.
Who really says that to a kid? Like, the kid's going to understand.
My dad's an asshole, but he never got to that level before. Jesus Christ. Like,
You know, he has to be that mean for you to really buy into the voodoo at the end. You're like, yes, you're right
earned.
There with that kid. You're like, kill that fucker.
You know who you remind me of? You remind me of I don't remember his name, but he plays a cop in Seinfeld, but he's like John Goodman Jr. in Halloween's Curse of Michael Myers. And like, he's like our introduction to his character. It's like, I think it's John Strode, I think his name is. He's just taking the axe to the sign. He's like, I'm sick of this Michael Myers bullshit. And like, he's just like, it just reminds me of like, all right, so these dads probably would have really gotten along at the bar. Like, it's like, I got my, my bass bastard son at home. Daniel, what about you? What are some quotes that when you think of Creepshow, like maybe what's the first
quote? I think most of the good quotes are from Jordy Verrill. Like those, he's so quotable.
Yeah.
Meteor shit and all that. I guess the one that I think about, there's two I think about, and they're both from Leslie Nielsen. There's the "It's Showtime," and he says that a couple times, and it's really kind of spooky. And then for no one else in the world would ever point this out, but for some reason, the way Leslie Nielsen says Ted Danson's character's name always sticks with me. He goes, "Wentworth."
Yeah.
Wentworth, little boy, I have the gun. There's something about the way he says Wentworth. It just rings in my head.
And I love that, though.
And I love his line that I can hold my breath a long, long time, too. Like, mm-hmm. It's so...
Yeah,
that's such a comic book line. Like, mm-hmm. Something so out of it. And especially, like, so the original ending of this was actually supposed to be where the police come. This would have been so stupid, but like the police come, they look at the footage and they see that like it was him confessing to all the kills and everything, and then it actually ends with him in a gas chamber and him saying like, "I can hold my breath a long, long time," or whatever, which seems more Tales from the Crypt than anything else, especially the first episode of Tales from the Crypt. But like it definitely hammers down that line a little bit more, but I really do love him, like how they do it, and the fact that he like ends with him in the water. So mm-hmm. I'm fine with that.
And then just the Wentworths when they're coming for him, and they're like essentially right in front of him saying, "Here we come, Richard. Let's go to the beach." And just mm-hmm. just casually talking to him, and it's just terrifying. It's just, mm-hmm. ugh, creepy.
Yeah. The part where they're creeping through his house is really effective, I think, too.
And the effect they put on their voices and that as the zombies, it's so mm-hmm. creepy.
It's so good. Mm-hmm. It's so good. And I guess so. Ted Danson did like a random roles for AV Club, and they asked him about this role, and the thing he said was that, like, well, to get the effect when you're underwater, I guess they put his head into like a fishing pole, like a fish tank. And so they actually had to have like all the sand that was like glued in there and all. And so they, you know, they filmed it outside with like the thing. And so he literally had to like be underwater for like long periods of time for these shots.
I was wondering about that.
That's the only way that I would probably want to be able to do it, because at any given time, you can either just tip that water over or pull your head out. You know what I mean? Like if it got to a point where you were uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, I think he was able to just like kind of get out like pretty fast. But it would have been great if they just, you know, buried both of them.
Just killed them?
Yeah, we're actually going to put you in the sand here. It's okay. Look, you'll be back for season 2.
You didn't read this in your contract. Yeah. But, this is going to be your last film.
He's like, "I got to get back to the bar. Frasier's coming."
Oh.
Well, that's it for the Creepshow then. Let's move on to our overall thoughts.
The bite marks, Henry. I guess he got his chance. I totally guess he did.
I can't do anything for you unless you stop being so goddamn elliptical. Now, just slow down. Tell me the whole story from the beginning. Can you do that?
What can we say? I love Creepshow. Jen, this is your first time watching. I'm interested to hear, what are your overall thoughts?
Yeah, this was so much fun. I think the first half of it, I think I absolutely loved. And I have a couple more problems with the second half. But, like, it was really fun. It was a great Halloween watch. I think I texted you, like, this is going into my Halloween rotation every year. I feel like it's a great kind of background watch also, you know. Just, it was so much fun. Like, you can feel, like, the love in this movie. And it was a hell of a toot to watch.
Well, if we're rating this, as we do with the book episodes, from 1 to 5 Pennywise, Bright Red, Pennywise clown noses,
it's 5 nails in the crate.
Oh, that's what it is.
5 nails in the crate.
1 to 5 nails in the crate.
We have like 8 different rating systems. So I know. Okay,
and
so
five
nails to work with. Yeah.
Is the best because we're keeping the creature at bay. Although spoiler alert, we know he gets out.
Uh-oh.
He's going to get out regardless.
Well, I mean, I guess you have to be a 5 to keep him in the crate the whole time. I think I'm going to give this a 4.5 nails in the crate. If there was an extended scene of Wilma coming back and killing Hal Holbrook, I would give it 5. So when that is shot, That'll get five nails for me. But yeah,
four.
Oh yeah.
You would have hated the original ending, which is apparently, yeah? I guess Savini wanted it so that when the box opens in the water, like her body parts float out also.
Oh yeah.
Which would have been a little. That would have been a much.
Little much. Hey, yeah, and you know she came back for the show, so they could easily just film that and drop it in.
Yeah,
you
know? She could be a zombie.
Then you get a five for me. You know. Yeah,
I like that. I like that.
There's actually a sequel floating around out there where the crate monster marries Billy.
Oh really? Hey, you know, maybe he'll appreciate her.
Yeah, well they get Joe Hill's voodoo doll and bring Vilma back through that way.
That sounds like a Tales from the Crypt episode.
It does, it does. Mac, what are your overall thoughts? And Rainey.
Oh, this is a, for me, this is a 4.5 nails in the crate, and throw some cockroaches on there. I think it holds up so well. It's so super entertaining all the way through. I was kind of dreading the rewatch because I had a lot of stuff going on that day, and I just had such a blast, and I just totally forgot about everything that I was doing and really just, you know, got into it. And I just forgot how fun it is and how much it really does capture that kind of Halloween spirit. And so to be watching it like midway through the month here was kind of perfect. Yeah. So for me, it's 4.5 nails in the crate.
Got 2 4.5. Daniel, how many nails are you giving it? Oh, you're muted.
I was going to say, I'm not going to fuck around here. 5 nails. This is quite simply one of my favorite movies of all time. Like last night, I did not have time to watch it, but I thought I'd throw it on and just try to, you know, I haven't seen it in a few years. And I mean, I watched the whole thing and I don't think I've had more fun all month. And I've been watching horror movies most nights. Like, it's just, I love this movie wholeheartedly. And it's not just nostalgia. I think it's a nearly perfect movie. And it is something that someone said, you could put it on in the background. It is a great movie just to show someone who's kind of just getting, you know, feet wet in horror, because it does have a sense of fun to it. And there's something kind of for everyone. Like the stories change up so relatively quickly and they're so high caliber in quality. I am a really only obsessed with two movies in life, and that's Night of the Living Dead and Creepshow. And I really don't feel like it's nostalgia bothering me. Like, I think this is a genuine kind of unique masterpiece that you could set very few other films next to that capture this kind of tone that's so scary and so funny. And it's weird, the word we keep coming up with is love. Like, you can feel the love in this thing, which is not something you can say about a lot of even horror classics. I don't know that you can say, you know, even something that's unimpeachably classic, like you could say, you know, The Exorcist or something, and say you feel the love. Now you feel the love here. Like, people are having a blast, and it is always a blast to watch.
100% agree. 5 nails for me. Perfect distillation of just everything that I love about Stephen King and everything that influenced King and all the masters of horror involved in this. I mean, Daniel, you're right. I mean, this is love. Like, it's the love for horror comes through in here, and it is a gateway movie. For me, it's my favorite horror anthology film. It juggles the tones in ways that no films in horror can, really. I mean, it's wild. I mean, because you're not just talking about comedy and horror. You're talking about pretty much all mediums of horror, from the short stories to the rags, to the comic books, to, you know, to the midnight movie. And this is the ultimate midnight movie. So just a cut above the rest, and a cut that I feel very few, if any, will ever come close to matching. So that's it, kiddies. It's time to head out of the basement and stash the comics away. Daniel, what is next for you?
You mean tonight or
just in general? Yeah.
You know, I've got this comic book that the first issue has just come out called The Autumnal. That's viewers or listeners can't see it, but there's
that's awesome. Sort of a
poster. Oh, cool. Cool.
Then it's an 8-issue comic, so that'll come out the second issue comes out at the end of October, and then it'll be a monthly schedule. And then I just published a book called They Threw Us Away, which is part of a trilogy for kids, actually, called The Teddy Saga, which is a, it's about teddy bears, which seems out of step with me, but you have to trust me on this, it's not. It is the darkest teddy bear tale of all time.
Oh, nice.
that sounds awesome.
And it's for kids, but it is genuinely, I think, pretty unsettling. So gather the kids around and freak them
out. Love it. Love it. God, you're busy.
This is
you might be the busiest person I've talked to during the pandemic in terms of like output right now.
Which is awesome. I had 5 books come out in 12 months, which is, I mean, it's absolutely insane. And I would never do this again. It was like,
yeah, I was going to say,
typically you're not even allowed to do such a thing, but all 5 projects just by weird happenstance were all radically different audiences. You had kids, adults, graphic novels, crime, young adult. So it's just like, it all happened sort of at once.
That's amazing. Well, congrats. And, you know, where can our listeners find you?
I would just say go to danielkrauss.com and that'll have the links to everything else.
Sweet. Sounds good. Sounds good. Speaking of which, what a seg. If you haven't already, please follow us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And if you haven't already, please, 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 double please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love some bright red Pennywise clown noses or nails, whatever you prefer when it comes to ratings at the Losers Club. Because we deserve it. We are your favorite. We are your devoted. We are your only Losers Club. Until then, we'll be seeing you over long days
and pleasant
nights.
Night.
Yay! Awesome.
I got some hot friends. 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 But you know you want somebody to treat you good.
This is the end of our show. For now, we hope you enjoyed this production. If you like our programming, consider searching for other bloody disgusting podcasts, such as Creepy, Horror Queers, The Boo Crew, SCP Archives, Nightlight, Margaret's Garden, and more.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.